Thank you. My talk sort of follows on from Rob's. It's probably a little more detailed than the most of you would probably like. It's fairly well aimed at the XID technique. So if you haven't seen XID patterns, you're going to see a lot of them today, and some of them represented in slightly different manner. As Rob's already talked on, a lot of the environmental aspects and certainly some of the field locations of these acid sulfate soils. Generally, he and his group go out there, bring back lots of samples, several salt samples, and they have a bit of a lottery to see who can guess what the salt is, because we've certainly seen a large number of them. So the outline of my talk, a little bit like Rob's, the first couple are pretty much the same as Rob's, so I'll go over those fairly briefly. So what are acid sulfate soils? Some of the hazards associated with them. We're almost identical slides to Rob's, so I apologise for that. Location of some of the study sites, and again, there's another site that Rob had mentioned in his slide, but listed in his slide, but didn't mention, was the Great Artesian Basin. And then we'll be looking at some of the mineralogical characterization of these efflorescences. There'll be some laboratory XID measurements, some ex situ experiments where you might heat the sample, allow the sample to cool to ambient temperatures, run the diffraction pattern, and then do some more treatments, etc. You run some risks of rehydrating some of these samples, particularly they're very easily rehydrated once they've been removed from their dry environments. So we then looked at several in situ type experiments, both with laboratory measurements. We did some synchrotron measurements in recent years, and we've recently purchased a laboratory controlled atmosphere device that we can do heating and humidity measurements while simultaneously collecting diffraction patterns and a few conclusions about the salts we've got. So what are acid sulfate soils? It's pretty much what Rob had put up there. They're sediments containing sulfide minerals, monosulfides, and or their oxidation products. Sulfuric if they contain detectable sulfides. Sulfuric if they've oxidized and their pH is less than 4 in Australia. It appears less than 3.5 in the US. Monosulfitic, these have been described as monosulfitic black oozes, the MBOs that we've mentioned. And again, just reiterating the reaction, 2 moles of pyrite with oxygen and water will generate 8 moles of acid. So it's a very, we generate quite a bit of acidity from this reaction. And again, this is just some of the phases that we may produce just from the acid reactions with the other minerals in the environment. Hazards associated, as we see acidification of the soil and water bodies if the samples are re-wet. Noxious gases, this is a small town along the Murray River where one of the wetlands was dried and subsequently re-wet, so quite noxious gases can affect residents. Deoxygenation of water bodies, when MBOs are dispersed, this is just MBOs just basically wafting through water body, removing oxygen from the water, and as you can see we can get quite significant fish kills. These are actually European carp, which are a noxious pest in Australia, so it wasn't altogether something they wouldn't try to avoid. Unfortunately, it's non-discriminating, so some of the native fish were also died, but I think the carp pretty much wiped out most of those, and of course impacts on biodiversity. So again, just a locality map of the Murray-Darling Basin. Pretty much all of this area drains into, actually, a lot of it's actually taken out from irrigation. There are huge tracts of land that have been opened up for irrigation, and much of the water that actually does fall in the southern Queensland and in New South Wales is actually taken out before it even reaches the Murray in South Australia. So the Murray River usually, or actually sometimes, exits in South Australia at the Murray mouth here. There are barrages here to maintain the water level in Lake Alexandrina and Lake Albert, but as we've seen, that in the recent years with drought, there's just been not enough water coming down the Murray River to actually keep these lakes underwater. Some of the areas we've looked at, Port Adelaide is a coastal acid sulfate soil that Rob showed recently. We've had areas in the Adelaide Hills here where there are seeps going through pyrite that are in the natural rocks, the tributaries to some of these lake systems, and also areas along the wetlands along the Murray River here. This is another area that Rob briefly mentioned. This is the Great Artesian Basin. This is now the eastern states of Australia. underlying much of Queensland, the northern parts of South Australia and New South Wales, is a very large water body, Great Artesian Basin. So it's a huge area of underground water. In South Australia, this is that small square here, in South Australia, this is basically drought areas, desert areas. So there are several area, points here which are mound springs, or springs where the water pressure has basically brought the water to the surface. You can see a picture here with this groundwater is actually bubbling to the surface as they, because it is very dry areas, they do precipitate a lot of salts, even though they're very reasonably low in salt concentration. Over many, many years, they produce, you know, some of these mounds here. This is a close-up picture that are some tens of metres high. So you can see that a lot of salts have been accumulating just through evaporation. Not all of them are acid. In fact, a great deal of them are actually alkaline. Some of the salts that we find there are mostly sodium carbonate and sodium bicarbonate salts, but several of them are actually quite acidic. In fact, some of the we found a couple of unusual minerals in here that that appear to be some of the first occurrences certainly found in Australia. We've seen some of these slides in Rob's talks. This is just a selection of some of the salt efflorescences that we see, ranging from quite white materials, probably either be magnesium, mixed sodium magnesium salts, sodium salts, ranging all the way through to quite yellow, greeny yellow, and then of course the orangey brown colours of probably schwermannite, those sorts of materials. This is not a complete list of some of the mineral, certainly the sulphate mineral species that we have found in a lot of these efflorescences. As you can see, a lot of different cations associated with these, some sulfate and hydroxysulfate salts, sodium magnesium, aluminium salts. Some we've done a little bit of work on, but I won't be presenting here, the sodium magnesium sulfates. As Rob mentioned, some of these ammonium salts that are usually associated with dairy farming, so they're either fertilisers that have come in from the system or waste products from the cattle. Very few sodium salts, chlorine salts, sorry. Sodium chloride is found in most of them, but very few mixed sulfate and chloride salts. And as you can see here, quite a range of colours and morphologies. Our weapon of choice in identifying these is, of course, X-ray diffraction. We have a reasonably new instrument, the Panalytical Expert Pro. I sort of point this out mostly because it's quite an interchangeable instrument. You can change a lot of the sample changes, the detector systems, and the slit system, so you can actually modify this instrument depending on what you're doing. And we've actually done that using a controlled atmosphere stage on this instrument. It has a silicon strip detector. It's basically the same as having 128 detectors analysing at the same time. So you can collect extremely fast diffraction patterns. We tend to run it a lot slower and usually at its highest resolution just to improve the quality of the XRD patterns. As you, we are analysing with the current PDF4 database from the ICDD. This is the most up-to-date version, which in some cases you actually need because of the complexity of some of these diffraction patterns, which is what I'll show you now. Fortunately, we're not expected to identify all the peaks that are associated, say, in this sample, just from one sample. Fortunately, we are able to, Rob comes back with lots of different salt samples, and hopefully we can find maybe a couple of these mineral phases if we're lucky in a single sample, but more often than not, we do end up with something that has maybe a dozen crystalline phases. Fortunately, some of the early work back in the late 90s was some of the earliest work we did on some of these salts. This was Mount Torrens in the Adelaide Hills, where a stream had actually cut into a bank and exposed what was probably an old swamp system. It's fairly clay material above, but the sandy layer below was precipitating these yellow crystals. I think Rob initially thought it was a jarosite of some sort. So it came to the lab and we analysed it, relatively simple diffraction pattern, mostly quartz, quite a bit of gypsum in this sample. There was a jarosite. Unfortunately, gypsum does overlap the strongest line of jarosite in here, so it was a bit problematic in determining whether it was a natural jarosite or the potassium form. There was a 10 angstrom peak that we sort of couldn't really identify. We thought maybe it was a biotite of some sort. It was a slightly higher angle, a slightly higher despacing. But in order to try and identify what the jarosite phase might have been, we decided to heat the sample to 105 for a couple of hours just to dehydrate gypsum, which is what we did, form bassonite. So now we can see the peak that was overlapped by the gypsum now is indicating that it was in fact a natural jarosite. But surprising to us, when we analysed the pattern using the search match, we found this mineral metasiderotenatrite. So of course you figure, well, if it's meta in this form, then there must be a siderotenatrite somewhere. So putting that pattern into the database, and this is the siderotenatrite pattern that came up. There are only two patterns in the database. One is a deleted pattern from the early 60s. This one is dated 1967 from the set number here. As we see, we do have a peak that matches the siderotenatrite here. Maybe a few small peaks here, possibly, but some of the other stronger lines, they're really not matching at all. At this stage, hadn't even heard of this mineral before, so we looked on the internet and managed to locate a few samples, and before they actually were delivered, we're a little bit impatient, actually getting ahead of myself here. So siderotenatrite from the Handbook of Mineralogy, it's the Greek word, just combining its chemical composition for iron and sodium. It's an uncommon secondary mineral, mostly found in oxidized zones of iron-rich deposits, often in mine areas, particularly dry ones. It's also formed by the alteration of pyrite and saline water in coal seams, and some of the more important ones are in sea spray environments where, I guess, the saline water leaching through these cliffs with pyrite generally precipitates siderotenatrite on the cliffs. Interestingly, it says soluble in boiling water, and a lot of the papers actually say that it's quite insoluble in cold water. So I thought, okay, well, that's fine. It does reversibly dehydrate to metasiderotenatrite, which we've shown, depending on relative humidity and exposure to sunlight, or temperature, I guess. It's an order-disordered structure, and I'll show that in a little minute, and it's an orthorhombic crystal structure. Anyway, while we're waiting for the natural specimens to arrive, I'm a little impatient, so I had a look on the internet and found a paper by Flynn and Isel, 1987, from the Bureau of Mines. They were looking at trying to remove iron, very high concentrations of iron and sodium from sulfate solutions. So they were synthesising this material, quite a simple reaction, iron 3 sulfate, a bit of sodium sulfate, a pinch of sodium bicarbonate. It produces quite a dark brown solution. The pH measured at that point is about 2.2, so it enables us to give us some idea maybe what pH is this particular effervescence forms under. It's a fairly slow reaction. Nothing happens for a couple of days. Just brown solution sits there, and then usually on the morning of the third day, there'll be quite a thick deposit of this really bright yellow precipitate on the bottom of the container. Their procedure for drying it was to for rinsing it, washing it before basically ending up with a dry powder, was to mix it with a mixture of acetone and 50% dilute sulfuric acid. Slowly, gradually reduce the amount of dilute sulfuric acid until you end up with 100% acetone, then just allow it to dry to air. And when we ran the diffraction pattern, so we've got quite a good crystalline pattern here. This sort of shape down here is indicative of the order disorder. Because of the three water layers that is generally in here, they get a little bit of stacking disorder in the sample. Unfortunately, in my sample, I didn't wash it terribly thoroughly, so I end up with a small amount of sodium sulfate left in here. And again, because I'm impatient, I thought I'd just throw it in water because the literature said it's not really soluble in cold water. It dissolved almost immediately, contrary to the papers, and within minutes it started precipitating this rather orangey-looking, very fine-grained material. We filtered it, washed it, and ran a diffraction pattern, and lo and behold, the diffraction pattern is quite indicative of schwertmannite. So, okay, this is something unusual. I hadn't really expected this. So this maybe indicates possibly another pathway to the formation of schwertmannite. Rather than directly from solutions, it's now forming as a result of dissolution of siderotenatrite. And Rob's already pointed this in his original diagram, that we've got the siderotenatrite here in the stream bank being formed in here as the waters are still pushing the material out, falls into the water, and then within minutes it's precipitating this thin line of schwertmannite in the environment. Again, Rob had these in a couple of different slides. So this is the edge of aerial photos of the edge of Lake Albert or Alexandrina. I'm not sure, probably Lake Alexandrina. So the yellow siderotenatrite on the ground, it's quite brightly yellow. After some rainfall, it transforms almost immediately to schwerpenite. So you've got this this red-brown sort of gel, almost amorphous material, very fine-grained. It has a, some significance in that it could be a possible mechanism for taking up some of the heavy metals or arsenic and some of the other metals in the structure, and that's something we'll probably look at in the future, is maybe see how this material might take up aluminium or some of the heavy metals. Reading through some of the literature, there aren't too many papers on pseudonatrite out there in the literature. There are several looked at the dehydration products, and we actually used some of them to work out that we could dehydrate to metapseudonatrite. Some heat them further to 250, and we end up with what I'm calling anhydrous, some call it metapseudonatrite 2, which has all the water removed. Looking at a DTA analysis, we ran DTA of this. So this is the temperature profile up here, up to 1,000 degrees Celsius. This is the TGA, so this is the weight of the sample as you're heating the sample. You get quite a weight loss initially, up to about 130 degrees. It levels off a little bit and then starts to dehydrate further up to 220. This is the DTA trace, which shows a couple of exothermic peaks due to the removal of the water. Another one out here, that is the removal of the hydroxyls in the structure. And then I guess this is probably the start of the sulfur starting to come out of the structure is SO2. This DTA also has mass spectrometer, and this was just the water trace, so you can see two quite strong peaks at the lower temperatures are showing water being removed from the system, and then the hydroxyl coming out here. Now here's where we look at some of the points, looking at some of the XID instrumentation. We looked at in-situ heating, so the previous one was an ex-situ, where we run it and then look at the sample. And I think some of the confusion with the dehydration of this material was actually confused. They'd heat the sample, then reintroduce it back to the diffractometer, and in that short time, it would partly rehydrate. So they were seeing sort of a transient between the two hydration states. So this is where we looked at, this is a, I should just acknowledge Ian Madsen from CSIRO Minerals in Melbourne. They have this laboratory system where they have an NL position sensitive detector. It covers 120 degree 2 theta. So you can simultaneously collect a diffraction pattern in a very short period of time, usually within about a minute, where normal pattern might take, 120 degrees might take you 45 minutes. It's an X-ray tube here with a parabolic mirror generating a parallel beam onto your sample. This is a sample that's loaded into a glass capillary, has a small diameter hole in the center, so you pack the capillary with your sample. This is a hot air blower generated by compressed air. It has coils in here that are heated up, controlled by a thermocouple, which sits just below the sample, and you can control the heating. So you can set the ramp up to temperature, and then you can actually collect diffraction patterns as the sample is heating. Soon after we collected that diffraction patterns, Australia's synchrotron was first finished. First experiments began in 2007. We were fortunate enough to get beam time in 2008 and 2009 to look at some of these dehydration reactions. So this is the aspirin, I think, from the air, it looks like. This is Monash University. It's just up here, so very close to Monash University and the CSIRO campus that Ian Madsen, my colleague, is situated. This is before any of the sample hutches were in, so there's virtually no instruments around the sample floor. We use the powder diffraction beam line. This is the X-rays come down this narrow tube through collimators, and it's collimated onto your sample, which sits around about here on the sample stage. Again, this has a position-sensitive detector, quite a large one, so it gives very high angular resolution. It's got 0.001 degrees angle resolution. A table where we've got our heating stage mounted. In this situation, what we decided to try, normally what we'd have is the sample in here and just the capillary was open. So we just relied on the natural opening of the capillary just to allow the excess moisture that was being exhaled from the sample. But what we decided we might try and do is try and remove some of the moisture with using a, in this case, a pressure or vacuum line. So we pull vacuum on the sample, so any moisture that was actually generated by heating the sample would be drawn out of the sample. And I'll show you the different reactions that we see with that. These instruments operate 24 hours a day. We had 2.5 days worth of beam time, so it's just not possible for one or two people just to run it. So I had a bit of technical help from Rob. He's not just useful out in the field. He can be called to help align some of these things. And Rob will tell you how easy it is to align these if you ask him. Just about a year or a year and a half ago, we were fortunate enough to be able to purchase this CHC. It's one of the new Anton Parr controlled atmosphere stages. It can do cryo, low temperature, down to -180 in a vacuum, but that's an optional extra. We didn't go for that. We've gone for the humidity and the heating stage. So we can, just with compressed air cooling, we can get down -5 degrees up to 400 in a vacuum, -5 to 300 in air or nitrogen, and also alter the relative humidity while collecting the diffraction patterns from 5% up to 95% relative humidity. So we can look at some of the rehydration experiments as well as the dehydration. Different atmospheres you can use it. This is the relative humidity generator. It uses a series of mirrors to work out the dew point of the air passing through the system, so it's quite smart. And we can get, just from a few measurements we've done recently, we're getting probably plus or minus 0.5 to 1% relative humidity changes that we can use in our sample. So this is just what it looks like attached to our XRD instrument. The humid air comes in through here. It's a double jacket system. We have warmer water circulating around the outside to reduce any condensation. And then the air is just gently blowed onto your sample. This is the sample stage here. Has a thermocouple just underneath the holder. It's a resistive heating element, and we can control that temperature by the software that operates the XRD. So this is the laboratory system with the position sensitive detector. So what we're seeing here is just basically what I've done is, right, we did actually collect the XRD patterns continuously, but this is just slices at the different temperatures. So we've got 25 degrees at room temperature, is a zero natrite. As you can see, the data quality is not as good as the normal laboratory. These are 1 minute XRD patterns collected, and we're ramping the temperature up at 10 degrees per minute. So they're fairly coarse temperature steps. If we stack all the temperature, the XRD patterns now we're looking at about 70 or 80 diffraction patterns along here. And as we can see, as the temperature is increasing, the siderotenitrite is slowly dehydrating, and then as that's dehydrating, metasiderotenitrite is forming in here. And when that dehydrates, then this anhydrous siderotenitrite is forming. If we look from directly above this now, so now the intensity is now indicated by colour, so the background, the lowest intensity is dark purple basically, and the highest intensity is white, going through red, through the rainbow colours. So we can see at about 105 degrees Celsius, we're getting the conversion of the siderotenitrite to metasiderotenitrite, and then from meta to the anhydrous form. It's not a gradual change, it's just basically one form or the other. You lose the two layers of water basically. And this the meta siderotenitrite is much more structurally stable and it's more ordered than the siderotenitrite. Synchrotron data, as you can see, it's much higher quality, higher resolution. The background, the peak to background ratio is much higher now for the synchrotron data. Now we're only collecting for 10 seconds. We've got several orders of magnitude of intensity. We're still heating at the same rate, but we still pretty much get the same result. 105 degrees Celsius for the first conversion, and then 195 degrees for the second. Nothing new there. When we applied the vacuum to try and remove some of the moisture so that it wasn't sort of slowing down the reaction, we can see that the actual temperature has now dropped to 69 degrees for siderotenitrite and 165 for the metasiderotenitrite conversion. We still think that at this stage, we're still thinking, well, that's not a bad outcome, but probably it's still a little bit high because we're still not removing enough of the moisture from the system. It is an enclosed capillary, and it still does take time for, say, the moisture to come out at the end of the capillary. Now this data is for the laboratory, the CHC, our in situ CHC controller. Now this time we're actually much lower, slower temperature ramp. Basically, this is a step ramp. So you increase the temperature 1 degree. You collect the diffraction pattern, then it ramps up 1 degree, and then it collects the diffraction pattern. And we're measuring about 3 minute XRD patterns on here. it's fairly open. While this is measuring, we're blowing a dry nitrogen over the sample. So this is also aiding in the removal of any moisture that's in the system. So as we can see, the temperature at which it dehydrates has now dropped to about 55 degrees Celsius for acetonitrite to metacetonitrite, and then about 150 for the anhydrous phase. We were a little bit curious because many of the samples that we got from the field were pretty much the pure acetonitrite form. We didn't see any metacetonitrite, so we're just curious why it's fairly dry and some of the temperatures are quite high up in the riverlands, while we didn't actually see any metacetonitrite. So what we did, we took some of the sample from Lake Alexandrina. This is mostly sand particles here, and the yellow nodules here are the acetonitrite. And we basically left it out, and it was quite a hot Adelaide day, 40 degrees Celsius. We just left it sitting on outside in the sun. After a couple of hours, brought it in, ran the diffraction patterns, and yes, it had in fact dehydrated to the metacetonitrite form. We then brought it back into the laboratory after running the XID pattern fairly rapidly, and left it sit for a couple of hours, and then it fully rehydrated to the acetonitrite form. So it does quite readily dehydrate and rehydrate. In fact, it dehydrates even at room temperatures. We had a fairly, we just dialed up 0% humidity. It wasn't able to maintain that. I think the dry nitrogen had a small amount of moisture in it, 2%. But even still, we pretty much got almost complete dehydration of the acetonitrite. This is over about an hour, 1 hour of blowing this dry air over the sample. And we've converted pretty much all of the acetonitrite here, is virtually none left up here, to the meta form. We then thought, well, we'll try and rehydrate this stuff, see how easy it is. This is over 3 hours, probably leaving it for a couple of days or a day or two would have completely converted it. So here we started with the meta form here, and it's now starting to rehydrate after a few minutes. And after about 3 hours, it's about 50-50. So it hasn't completely rehydrated, but it's certainly some way towards that rehydration. So acetonitrite, not so uncommon, as was mentioned in the handbook. These are a few samples that we did obtain from mineral dealers. There's one here, Capitol Reef in Utah. It does show a couple of morphologies for this mineral. Some of the larger specimens are actually quite needle-like. They can be a few millimetres in length only tens or hundreds of microns in thickness. This one here from Italy is more like the materials that we've seen. Two almost type minerals. I think it was originally found in, the mineral was originally described from Chile, from one of the San Simón mine. And these are both the very fibrous type minerals. There was one locality in South Australia that was uncovered, and this is Wadnaminga. This is a gold mine. This is basically sitting on a piece of rock that has a very high pyrite content. These are all pyrite crystals in here. Finniss River near the Murray, Lake Eyre, which is one of the Great Artesian Basin samples, Boggy Lake, which is the north part of the lake system, Nelwart, which is near the border of New South Wales, Victoria, and various other sites we've actually found acetonitrite. So pretty much every acid sulfate soil we've looked at, if the pH sort of indicates it, and there's these yellow precipitates, we're finding acetonitrite. So in conclusion, the efflorescences formed from these acid sulfate soils are very widely distributed. Pretty much every acid sulfate soil in dry environments, you probably wouldn't see it so much up in the tropics. In fact, I don't think they see too many salts up there at all. They mainly see like the jarosites and the schwerpmanites, ferrohydrites. They're very complex, they have many diffraction peaks, and often in a single sample you'll have several hydration states, which only complicates the identification. That's why it can often be useful to do some dehydration experiments just to help identify these phases. They readily hydrate and dehydrate depending on temperature and humidity, not just the acetonitrite but pretty much all of the hydrated sulfate salts. They're transient in nature. So one day you might go out there, it's dry and hot, and there's lots of salts around. The next minute, it might have a small amount of rainfall, and then it's all been washed away. It's gone. They can transform to lower solubility secondary phases, for example, the schwerpmanite that we saw in here. And they do contribute quite significantly to environmental issues on rewetting, acidification and release of metals. And they do indicate some of the biogeochemical processes that occur beneath the soil surface. I'd just like to acknowledge again Ian Madsen for using his position sensitive texture instruments. That was most useful. We had two beam time allocations, not just looking at this mineral, but some of the other sulfate salts that I haven't reported here. So Kaya Walwalk is the powder diffraction beamline scientist at the Australian Synchrotron, and my co-authors, Rob Peter and Paul Shand. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions for Mark?
A bit technical.
I had a question about the mechanism, maybe if you had any idea about I think the dehydration is like a first step towards going to Schwarzmannite.
No, the dehydration is really just removal of water, waters of hydration. So you're going from acetyl nitrite to Schwarzmannite in the water study. It's just a dissolution, and I guess something we started doing was looking at concentration of the solid to liquid to see if we get variation in the precipitation. And unfortunately, the staff member that was doing that for me pretty much left almost immediately, and unfortunately we didn't recover his notebook. So, but some of the samples that I ran, we've actually seen some natural jarosite forming in those solutions as well as as the Schwarzmannite. So it's probably pH dependent. You know, these things go into water and they do lower the pH quite significantly, and depending on the proportion, will dictate what mineral species get to, transformed. It's actually quite different. I'm not exactly sure. Acetyl nitrite is an orthorhombic structure. Natural jarosite, I think, is hexagonal. I'm not entirely sure about that, but they are quite different. The structure has only just been determined by Professor Scordari that Rob showed soon after we visited them. The paper for the structure was published in American Mineralogist just this year. So if you want to look at the structure, you can, it's in American Mineralogist.
Let's thank Mark again.